As usual, I would like to start by seeing what questions you have. First, questions about stuff we did Monday, and then questions about readings that you have done that we didn't discuss Monday. So let's start with Monday's class. Was there anything we covered then that you'd like to talk about? Those are the different things that people could do, something going on.
Yeah.
Right. So here, for outcome A, these are different possible situations. If my fires is 400, switching to clover costs 800, and a spark arrestor costs 1100, then the lowest cost alternative is a fire, right? And the next situation is we're changing the assumed costs, and now the least expensive is clover. Here we're changing the hand of the spark arrestor and my next class, because I'm afraid I had forgotten that chunk of it, not having gone over it in class for some time, and I had better figure out what it is. All right, anything on the readings that we did for this week that we haven't covered yet that you want to talk about before I start on it? All right, let me review sort of where the spaghetti diagram comes out, as it were, because it's an attempt to show how if you only knew enough, you could figure out the right legal. And the general procedure is, given this starting point,
how would we get to this result, which you would think of as either if it's the right result, we'll always get there, or if it's the right result, we might get there, but there will be costs to doing it such that sometimes won't happen. All right? And you could then imagine that you're sort of sitting there in the clouds designing the legal system, and you somehow know that in all the cases these legal rules will apply to, in 2% of them there will be 100 farmers, and in 1% there will be 106 farmers, and in 4% there will be 73 farmers. You have a probability distribution over the number of farmers. Does that make sense? And you also know that in each of these cases, the efficient outcome has some probability of being Sparta Rester, some probability of being Clover, some probability of being Fires. All right? So you have a probability distribution for how many farmers there are, and there's only one railroad. You could obviously throw in that, which would make life even worse. A probability distribution for what the efficient outcome is. But you have to go further than that to care not only what the efficient outcome is, but how efficient is it. If there's a transaction cost to getting here, and here is just a tiny bit better than there, then you're probably not going to do it. Whereas if it's a lot better, then you're much more willing to do it. So you have a probability distribution over how expensive fires are if they occur, and a probability distribution over how much it costs to switch to Clover. Given all that information, for those of you who sort of are used to thinking of mathematics and integrals over probability distributions and fancy stuff like that, you could imagine calculating, averaging over all cases that will ever occur, what are the net costs of this rule, of this rule, of this rule, of that rule. And you would then pick the rule for those are the lowest. That's the logic of what you would do if only you knew enough.
All right. And why is this worth doing, given that we don't actually have all that data?
And part of the answer is that knowing how we would solve the problem if we had the data gives you at least qualitative kinds of answers without it. So, for example, you can say, in making legal rules, here is how the number of farmers affected. That the more farmers, if you're imagining some rules for situations like this with small numbers of people, some with large numbers, you can say, well, the larger the number, the harder the public good problem is, and the harder the holdout problem is. And therefore, maybe for the large numbers, we should prefer rules that don't require us to solve those problems. For small numbers, it's not, we don't worry about that. And that, it seems to me, the kind of thing that this analysis is doing all over the place, that as you think about, we don't really have a good theory of transaction costs. But we know that if you have a bilateral monopoly bargain, big bargaining ranges are likely to lead to high transaction costs. And that gives us a reason why when your factory is making noise that's keeping me awake, I should have the right to sue you but not to enjoin you. People follow the connection between that and bargaining costs? Because closing down your factory might cost you millions. Losing sleep costs me thousands. Therefore, the range, if you imagine an injunctive remedy, if we imagine that I, the neighbor, have the right to insist on your stopping making noise from your factory, which you can only do by shutting down the factory. In that case, it's worth millions to you to get my permission to make noise. It costs only thousands to me to give you that permission. Consequently, there's a bargaining range of millions of dollars between the lowest price I would accept and the highest price you would pay. And if you think about the logic of bargaining, it means it's worth both of us spending a lot of lawyers' resources and arguing and all sorts of other things trying to push the outcome to our side of that range. Does that make sense?
Yes, no?
All right. So that would be sort of an example where we don't have a really good theory. We can't say if the bargaining range is $1 million, transaction costs will be $33,000. But we can say if the bargaining range is $1 million, transactions costs will probably be higher than if it's $100. All right, and that's enough to give us some useful information in figuring out what the rules ought to be. Let me take one of the distinctions that's in the spaghetti diagram things, but apply it more generally, and that's the distinction between property rules and liability rules, which is the same thing as my injunction versus damages. All right, the property rule says, if I want to use your car, I must have your permission. And at least in theory, we enforce the property rule by saying, if I take your car without your permission, very bad things will happen to me. I'll go to jail. And therefore, it'll practically never happen. And that's an exaggeration. We'll get to criminal law and discuss more precisely the question of how you deter crime and how much. But for our present purposes, I think it's sufficient to imagine that criminal law is perfectly enforced, so that if something is defended by a property rule, that means that nobody ever uses it without the owner's permission. If somebody is defended by a liability rule, on the other hand, that means that anybody who wants to can use it, but then owes the owner a damage payment for the cost to him of their use. Is that a clear distinction? And if you think about it, really, our legal system protects certain things with one of those and certain things with the other. That my car is protected by a property rule. My right not to have you dent my car is protected by a liability rule. And almost all the right to have a contract fulfilled is almost always protected by a liability rule. All right. What would we call it if it was protected by a property rule? What's the legal term for a contract right where I can compel you to do it as opposed to just charge your damages for not?
Compel you to do it?
Yeah. What's the situation where it's illegal for you to break your contract? What right do I have? The right to what?
Specific
performance. Exactly. That's what specific performance is. And again, in the real world, obviously, I can't literally make an opera singer sing or a baseball player play baseball. But you can have a legal rule which says the penalty for not doing that is much, much higher than the real damage done. So, in effect, we're trying to force you. And if you think about it, with a property rule, how do people get use of my car if they value it more than I do? They buy it or rent it from with my permission. So that requires a market transaction. With a liability rule, how do they get use of something? How do you get out of a contract under ordinary contract damages rules? But it's not a negotiated payment the way it would do specific performance. It might be you could pay to be let out, or you could just stop performing the contract and the other guy sues you and you owe some damages. All right? So that suggests that property rules make a lot of sense where market transactions are an easy way of moving things to their highest valued use. And that liability rules make sense where market transactions work badly, but where the courts can do a reasonably good job of judging what costs and values are. What are some reasons why market transactions might work badly? Consider some of the cases where we really do use liability rules. That might be one.
Get out of it with, I think, title. If he doesn't agree to like release you of the contract, then title to get a lawyer and then have the judgment actually be a proper judgment. It seems like in order to satisfy the parties or the party that the contract was reached against. So it seems like market transactions are, can go all over the place.
In particular, that's a case where the market transaction, again, might involve a bilateral monopoly with a big bargain. And in general, bilateral monopolies are not a very smooth way of doing market transactions as opposed to normal competition situations where you're the only seller and I'm the only buyer. That raises problems. How about another example? Why don't we use market transactions to allocate the right to dent my car? Yeah, I got to buy permission for everybody in San Jose, more or less. Everybody in the country, if I'm going to drive across the country. All right, so the transaction costs of getting permission from many, many people with a small probability of needing it from each would get very, very high. So therefore, it makes more sense to use the liability rule instead. So I think it's one of the many useful ways of sort of cutting up legal rules is to think about this distinction between, and it's not just for things, of course. It's also for rights. So if you think about the question, if I want to write a book which includes a chapter from your book, say I'm writing a textbook and this textbook covers lots of different things and you've got a chapter in your book that covers it really well,
and so I want to include all of that chapter in my book. Under a property rule, which is what we actually in theory have, I have to get your permission to do it. Under a liability rule, I include it. You go to court, and I pay some court-evaluated damages for doing it. What would, in that context, what do we? What's the term we use for the equivalent of a liability rule in the intellectual property context? What's that called?
For tax or
royalties?
No, royalties are usually negotiated. Infringement is what I've done. But what do we call a legal rule which says you can use my intellectual property without my giving permission, but then owe me some specified amount of money for using it? Happens to be the rule which is used almost entirely for one important form of intellectual property and which is occasionally advocated for others.
Fair use?
No, fair use, I pay you nothing.
Yeah.
If you own the copyright on a song and the song is paid and played on a jukebox, does the jukebox owner go to you and negotiate a payment for permission? No, it's a system of compulsory royalties, compulsory licensing. That's the important case I know of in the modern legal system. There's an organization, there's an ASCAP, something like that, which basically acts as the middleman, and there may be some way you can pull out, I'm not sure, but the normal arrangement, at least, is there's some fixed rule for how much they pay you rather than negotiating. And people have sometimes proposed, with regard to both patents and copyrights, a system of compulsory licensing in which we say, yes, you have a right to get money from this, but you don't get to decide whether or not somebody uses them. All right? And if you think more generally that what we're really transacting over is not things but rights, you can then think of all sorts of issues where some of which are handed. The law, standard nuisance law involves a lot of liability rules. Trespass law, I think trespass is mostly a property rule. I don't think you can normally trespass and then just say, well, look, I did no damage, so I owe you nothing. And in fact, copyright law, as you may know, strictly speaking, copyright law is the combination, I hadn't thought about that, of a liability and a property rule. How do you get a property rule to protect your copyright? First, how do you get a copyright?
You make it, I guess. Apply, right?
You don't have to apply.
You make it happen.
You put some work of intellectual property in some tangible form. It doesn't have to be very tangible nowadays, and you have a copyright. What right do you have at that point? If somebody violates your copyright, what can you do to him? People haven't taken IP law, I guess.
Yeah.
You can sue him for actual damages. You might. But the only damages you get at that point are actual damages. Now, suppose you register the copyright, which is what you were talking about. Registering the copyright gives you the right to collect statutory damages, which means you can collect damages that are much larger. You don't have to show you that you do any harm at all. All right. Well, that really is like a property rule, right? So in that sense, I hadn't thought about it before, in that sense, copyright really is enforced by a liability rule if you haven't registered it, and something like a property rule if you have. I wonder if there are any other cases like that. So the basic argument is that if all you have are property rules and transaction costs are zero, you're home free. It works just fine. Every right goes to whoever values it most. That's Coase theorem, essentially. If all you have are liability rules and courts are accurate and costless, you're home free, because anytime anybody wants something, he takes it and then pays the cost for it. And if it's worth more to him than the cost he imposes on the owner, then he's the one who ought to have it. And let's think about a different question, and that's the rule that we didn't much discuss that wasn't on the spaghetti diagram, and that's a fine rather than a damage payment. So suppose we're thinking about two alternatives of control some behavior, let's say throwing sparks, by giving the victim the right to collect damages, or by giving the state the right to collect a fine, which I'm going to assume is also based on damages. Right? A fine could be a way of enforcing a property rule, but I'm assuming a liability like fine, so that the state says, all right, this year you burned down $15,000 worth of wheat, we're going to fine you $15,000. What are the advantages and disadvantages of that over the liability version, where it's the victim who collects? Do you think of any disadvantage? Is there, yeah, is there any way in which the fine is or advantage even? What way is the fine better or worse? Both of them are the same disincentive to the.
It seems like with a fine, it causes the farmer to also think about his actions in the sense. I don't know if that's an advantage or a disadvantage, but he would also have to contemplate whether or not he was to grow wheat or grow clover.
Got it. That's right. That's right. That with the damage payment, the farmer can say, no reason to switch to clover, they're going to have to pay me for the wheat. With the fine, if the fine is collected and the sparks still keep coming, if the fine isn't enough to deter it, then the farmer says, well, I'm having these fires, I'm not getting compensated for them, I better switch to clover. Right?
Then that would end up relieving.
It might. You have to worry about the strategic situation we discussed before, where that happens, where the cheapest solution really is for the railroad to stop throwing sparks. But the railroad keeps throwing sparks in order that the farmers will switch to clover in order to stop paying damages. That would be a problem with the fine. That's right. So that's a disadvantage and an advantage. The advantage is that if the efficient solution is throwing sparks, now with the fine, the farmer has a solution to make it sparks plus clover, which we'll suppose is more efficient than sparks plus fires. All right? So that's an advantage. Can you think of any other disadvantages of the fine? It doesn't have to be in the railroad case, because really this is, among other things, partly a distinction between criminal law and civil law. Between government regulations sometimes and civil law, always achieving the same thing.
Well, I just wonder who's going to bring the fine, or
who's going to report the case, right? If it's liability, if it's damages, well, I've got an obvious incentive to go to court to call people's attention because I'm going to make some money. If it's a fine, why should I bother? All right. Let's think about this in the auto accident case. Because the auto accident is a case where it's quite likely that you've got joint causation, that either driver could have prevented the accident by being careful enough, although maybe one is more at fault than the other. And the fine is what I used to think of as double liability, meaning that each party has to pay for the damage he's done, and neither party gets paid for the damage done to him. All right? And that's got the virtue that gives each party an incentive to take all cost-justified precautions, because if he prevents the accident, he saves himself the amount of money damaged by it. And then the obvious response is the one that we just got, but then who's going to report the accident? In fact, even imagine that you took that I smashed your car and no damage was done to my car. What is the first thing that you are going to say after you, fortunately alive, get out of your car? What are you going to say to me? What market transaction are you going to propose to me? Yep.
That simply you paid damage to something.
And this is a world with fines. This is a world where if it gets to the attention of the authorities, he's going to have to pay the government the value of your car that he just smashed. So what's the proposal that you make to him?
I won't report it,
and you'll give me some of the money. Right? And one way of looking at it, and this is something we'll come back to much later, is that tort damages can really be seen as serving three unrelated functions. From this standpoint, what are tort damages?
What would be another term for the function that tort damages are serving as an incentive for the victim to report? No, that's a different function. That's the second one. What do we call a sum of money given to somebody for reporting a crime?
A reward.
A reward or a bounty. You know, $500 dead or alive. So tort damages are simultaneously
a bounty for reporting.
Now let's get back to the second one.
Restitution.
You call it restitution. What might an economist call it?
We're not interested in any morality.
What is it doing from the standpoint of the potential victim? Why do you feel better about the world if you know that if somebody smashes your car, they'll have to pay for it? Thank you for it. What?
Compensation.
All right. The word I was looking for was insurance. That there's a sense in which you can wish one way of thinking of tort damages is it provides the potential victim with insurance against losses. All right? It's true, it is compensation, but in terms of why he values it, that after all, I would like insurance even if the reason my car was smashed wasn't anybody else's fault. Still insurance. And the third function is its effect on the tort feasor, and that's deterrence.
Did I just misspell insurance? Insurance have 1 hour or two.
2 hours.
2 hours. Got it right the first time.
All right. So one way of thinking about a tort system is that it's doing three jobs at once. It's providing an incentive to report for the victim. It is providing insurance for victims against losses. And it's providing deterrence and incentive not to do certain things that result in harm to other people. And one of the problems if you're trying to do economic analysis of tort law is that there is no reason at all why the optimal rules should be the same for those three different purposes. All right? If all you were caring about was a bounty, then you would say that any publicly visible tort shouldn't have any damages, because we'll know about it already. All right? If all you're caring about for insurance, you would say, well, if anything bad happens to you, somebody else should have to pay you for it. That would be a silly rule for deterrence, and for deterrence, you want to think about giving people an incentive not to do things. And furthermore, as the example we just discussed with the fine suggests, sometimes they're in conflict. Because a fine, the same thing that makes a fine bad insurance, namely the money isn't going to the victim, also means that a fine gives better incentives because it gives an incentive for deterrence not to the tortfeasor, but to the victim. And it gives the victim an incentive to try to keep this from happening. So anyway, we'll get back to some of that later, but it is, I think, a real issue. And one which I think I come back to when we discuss value of life, for one thing, because that's one of the issues that you think. What's your life worth in tort? Anybody know? How does one decide what your life is worth in tort? And I want a number. What are the things, if a court is saying you've been tortiously killed,
potential earnings,
might be earnings, who is that value to? All of the things that go into the value of your life.
Your heirs.
So suppose that you are a retired person, you're not earning any money, although you're living off your pension or whatever, and you have no family depends on you. What is your life worth in modern tort law?
Zero.
Zero in principle, that's right. Hard to believe that can be the right answer. This is actually one of the best examples I know of against Posner's thesis. Because under common law, it's worth zero all the time. And under modern statutory law, it's worth something if your survivors are injured by your death.
Right.
But the value of your life to yourself doesn't count.
That's bizarre. That kind of, no one would report it if right, no one depended on you, or if no one was around, it seems
well,
like
it's not,
no one could bring a civil suit in order to seek
that. That is the original grounds, I think, were that the claim died with you. But you could easily enough imagine a legal system which said that not only do you have a claim if you're killed, but that claim can be sold in advance. Right? You can imagine a system where I go to him, and he's a lawyer or maybe a private detective or something, and I say, look, I got this deal for you. And the deal is you pay me $100 now, and I agree that if I am tortiously killed, you may collect the damages. And why am I doing this? Not making $100. I'm doing it because now someone has an incentive to collect the fine, and that gives people an incentive to be careful about not killing you. May not be worth doing, but sort of the logic of the situation is there. So we'll get back to that to this later. It's sort of an interesting set of issues that aren't usually discussed. All right, let's. So one further point before I go on to the close article. you're thinking about the right legal rule, whether liability versus property or other things, a lot of the of what determines it is fact-specific, is things like, is this the sort of thing which is likely to be seen and therefore not be rewarded? Is this a case where giving the damages to the victim will have a significant effect on his incentives, the precautions by the victim matter, or something like that? And one of the things that suggests, to me at least, is an argument in favor of freedom of contract. Because a contract is making rules for a little two-person society or separate society, the contracting parties. And if what the right, if there isn't a right rule, if there's only a right rule for these particular circumstances, that's an argument for leaving the parties free to pick the rule. And one of the things we'll get to much later is the refusal of courts to allow parties to negotiate a property rule for breach of contract. What would you, suppose you wanted, that's one way it would be specific performance, and they won't normally enforce specific performance with some exceptions. Other than specific form of performance, if you wanted the equivalent of a property rule for breach of contract, suppose you said, look, the courts are really terrible at evaluating damages, and lawyers cost much too much. I want to set it up like this. We're going to agree that if you breach the contract, if you want to breach the contract, you have to go to me and get my permission to do it. How would we write the contract to get de facto that result? And what would happen? How do we make sure that you've got to get my permission? How do we make sure you've got to get my permission to use my car?
You say you get arrested.
Well, that's one way, but more generally by arranging that very large costs will be imposed on you now. What do we call an agreement by which you say that if you breach the contract without my permission, you will have very large costs imposed on you? That's right. It's liquidated damages A. But the particular kind of liquidated damage is called a penalty clause, namely liquid damage is much larger than the actual damage. And that's one of the grounds on which courts refuse to enforce that liquidated damages. So you've got the interesting characteristic that the court system itself imposes property rules in lots of places, but at least in this case it won't allow a contract to enforce property. We'll come back to that point later as well. Notice that this is also perhaps an argument for industry arbitration schemes rather than courts on the grounds of the industry. It might be that the right rule for this industry is this kind of liability rule. The right rule for that industry is a property rule. The right industry for the rule over there is a fine rule where the money goes to the fund for widows of people in this industry or something. You can think of if you want to set up the equivalent of a fine, you can do it by having the money go to somebody other than the plaintiff. All right, let's go on to COSE. Questions on the COSE article? Before I start going through bits and pieces of it. All right, one basic point, we've been through it great length, is that the problems we call externalities are normally jointly caused. They're the result of decisions by both parties. Then the next chunk of that, which doesn't really depend on, though I guess in a way it does, is this farmer versus cattleman story. And the basic point of that story is that you would think that in a world where cattlemen were liable to damage by their trespassing cattle, beef would be more expensive than in a world where they weren't. And you would think that in a world where cattlemen were not liable for trespassing cattle, that grain that the cattle trespass would be more expensive than it was. That's the obvious. And Coase argued it isn't true. But that's part of what makes it interesting. His basic argument is that while it's true that in one of the world's farmers would be richer and the other ranchers would be richer, that whichever way the rule goes, the optimal, first it will pay the two parties to contract to solve the problem in the optimal fashion, which might be by reducing the number of cattle, it might be by building a fence around the wheat field. And having done so, the effect of their doing so on the number of cattle it pays to produce and the amount of wheat it pays to produce is the same either way. That's the counterintuitive conclusion. people follow the argument, have questions about it? All right. That. Now, he notes the possibilities of bargaining on the way there. So that you could imagine the case where if the rule is that the farmer has to pay off the rancher to keep down his herd, the rancher might deliberately increase the size of his herd above the level that paid him in order to be paid to reduce it. Similarly, you could imagine the farmer planting crops in places where they're in the way of the cattle, or it would be much cheaper just to keep those places empty in order to get paid to stop it. But once all the dust is cleared and everybody's made all of the efficient contracts, now Coase argues the final result is going to be the same. Now, one point that's worth making, which he does make in that article, although he's agreed is correct since, is that although the Coase theorem says you always get an efficient outcome, it doesn't actually imply you always get the same efficient outcome. Because what you, according to how you define the rights, is going to affect how rich different people are. And you could imagine a case in which the value of what's being produced in part depends on how rich people are consuming it. So in the Coase's case of the rancher and the farmer, both of them are growing for the market. So how much beef sells for doesn't depend on how rich ranchers are. How much wheat sells for doesn't depend on how rich farmers are. Suppose we imagine, though, that for some odd reason, ranchers are all meat eaters and farmers are all vegetarians. Just that absurd. You can imagine that a vegetarian has qualms about killing animals, so he doesn't want to raise animals to be killed. In that case, a legal rule that holds that the rancher is liable means that, on average, ranchers are poorer than a legal rule that holds that they aren't liable. If ranchers are poorer, then consumers of meat are poorer. If consumers of meat are poorer, the equilibrium quantity of meat is less and the price is lower. And if you think it through, you're getting an efficient outcome in either case, but they're different efficient outcomes. Because remember that our definition of efficiency is measuring the value of things by what people will pay for them. And the value of something to somebody in part depends, therefore, on how much money he has, because that will affect how much he'll pay for it. Makes sense? Make sense? Yes? No? Find a point? Do you find a point? The Coase theorem says you always get an efficient outcome. Coase, in this article, writes as though you always get the same efficient outcome. That's reasonable enough because he's not imagining a case where the wealth shift as a result of changing the legal will actually affect the market for the goods because the goods are... He's implicitly assuming that the goods are not being sold to either the rancher or the farmer. There's a market out there where people are buying wheat and meat. But if they were, then changing the relative wealth is going to change the outcome. And let me give you my much simpler example of that. And this is a two-person world, me and you. And the world has a bunch of moderately valuable goods, some of which I have and some of which you have. And then it has one good, which is a pill, which if you take it once, will double your life expectancy. And it was made by the Martians, or they forgot the formula or something. There's never going to be another such pill. There's only one, there are only two of us. Suppose I start out with the pill, plus half of the other goods, roughly, and you have half of the other goods. Can you buy the pill from me? Zero transaction cost the world, you don't get the pill. Because the total value to me of doubling the amount of other stuff I have is less than doubling my life expectancy by having to do. Right? So, if Coase theorem is right, the efficient outcome must be one in which I have the pill. That sounds pretty good. Suppose you started out with the pill. Can I buy it from you? No. So, according to the initial allocation of rights, who starts out with the right to this pill, we get quite different outcomes, both of which are efficient. Why? Because in the first outcome, we are measuring the value of the pill to me, given my wealth, which includes owning the pill, and the value of the pill to you, given your wealth, which doesn't include owning the pill. And consequently, the pill is much more valuable to me. Just so it would be much more valuable to me if I were a billionaire and you were a poor person. Remember, this is one of the limits of the economic efficiency definition, is that it's not measuring utility, it's not measuring happiness, it's measuring willingness to pay. Switch it, if you start, now you're the billionaire and I'm the poor person, and now the efficient outcome is allocated to you. Alright? Yes? It's not clear this isn't very much important to the real world, because most of these decisions
much affect distributions of wealth, but it certainly is a logical possibility, and therefore one that one has to consider in working through the logic of Costa. I'm reasonably sure that Costa is invested somewhere, but not in that article.
All right.
Coase runs through, I think, mostly in that article, a bunch of other cases, all of which involve the question of who has what rights. And one of the particularly interesting ones is a pair of related cases. I think they're in that article. And they both involve rights to the flow of air, or both English cases, I think. We have two buildings here. Those are windows. I'm not a very good artist. And this building has got a smokestack. And smoke has been flowing out of that smokestack, going this way or that way or somewhere else for a long time. And the owner of this building decides his building isn't big enough. So he builds his building up to here, and he then piles a bunch of stuff that he needs to put somewhere up on top of the building like that. And what do you think happens? What? The wind can't blow across anymore. And so, according to the owner of this building, his building is full of smoke because the smokestack won't draw. So he sues. Right? His claim is, I have an established property right to be able to put my smoke out into the wind blowing across it. You have blocked my property. And he loses his status. But we then have another case. And the other case involves a brewery, which is in a basement somewhere. And it happens that there is an old, long-abandoned mine shaft that runs from the brewery under somebody else's property and then comes up in someone else's yard. And the brewery, for many years, has used that as a vent to vent the fumes from their brewing. And the owner of this yard decides, rather than enjoying the pleasure of having these alcoholic fumes come up into his yard, he finds it a nuisance, so he decides to close up the vent. And now this is the real nuisance, is how am I going to operate my brewery with no way of ventilating it? And so the brewery owner sues. He wins. All right. So we've got two cases, both of which are for the right of to a place to have air flow through, essentially, going in opposite ways. And the doctrine in which he wins, by the way, is quite interesting. There is apparently a legal doctrine which says that if there is something which is the sort of thing that's property, and you've been treating it as property for long enough, not quite the same thing as adverse possession, though it's very similar. This is called the doctrine of lost grant, if I remember Coase's explanation. The doctrine is basically, it will be assumed that you at some point have gotten the legal right to do it and just lost the paperwork since you've been doing it all this time. So therefore, the position was that by the doctrine of lost grant, he owned the right to have. Now, it could be, it's possible that English judges are biased in favor of beer, and this could be one reason for explaining this particular case, since it was a brewery. There are other possible explanations. But the interesting point, of course, is that if Coase is right, the actual, it matters to the people involved who's going to have to pay who, but the real outcome isn't important. You can affect by this. Because if it's really the case that the cost of this guy of having fumes is $100, and the cost of this guy of putting in some other ventilation is $500, what do you think is going to happen? Suppose the law went the other way. Suppose he had the right to block them. Yeah. This guy's going to go against that. Like to buy the right to do it. And if it went the other way, make this 100 and this one 500. Then, given the way the case goes, that guy could have said, "I'm willing to buy your agreement that you won't put beer fumes into my yard." And similarly here, you could imagine this guy paying off this one to stop stacking stuff, maybe. Arguably, you could pay him off to take down the thing, maybe. But you could imagine in advance, if they anticipated it, that this guy could have gotten from this one an easement, some probably called an easement, it probably would,
but basically an agreement that he would not build his house any higher because of the deed. Alright? And so those are real cases. And the I think I went through with you the cases a week or so ago, so that was one of his, as you know. He has some other cases. He's got a case from Florida where swimming pool, fancy hotel, someone else built a hotel here, and the sun's there. Swimming pool is no longer in the sun, which is a very serious problem if you're trying to get people to come to your hotel in Florida and enjoy the beautiful weather. And so the owner of this hotel sues, I think loses, but I'm not sure. But again, the question is, do property rights include the right to the stream of sunlight that is coming across? Can you see why that particular question might become much more important in the future? Why might we care?
We won't be able to build longer because we have to go.
Well, I wasn't thinking of that. Why are we likely to care more about streams of sunlight all over the place in the future?
Solar power.
Yeah, solar power. That is, I don't know how much of people have been paying attention to it, but there's a sense in which solar power is the elephant in the room. Because at this point, solar power is more expensive than fossil fuel, but not enormously more. I don't know, maybe it's twice as much or something. It's a new technology, and the cost has been falling quite rapidly. So it would not be astonishing if 10 years from now, in many places, it was cheaper than fossil fuel. And if so, rights to sunlight matter. And if I've got... You could easily enough imagine a case in the future where... Here is my not terribly high big building with big solar panels here. And what might happen, and it might even be for the deliberate reason that he wants to put his solar panels. Indeed, it not only could happen, it in some sense did happen, and did happen in Santa Clara County. Somebody pointed out to me a few years ago when I was teaching this course a news story where I no longer remember all the details. I should see if I can find it. I don't know if it's still up on the web. But basically, you have somebody who had put up solar panels and then sued his neighbor for having trees that were too tall. And I no longer remember the sequence. It was a somewhat complicated case. And I think they ended up with a compromise, as I remember. But I think the trees just kept growing. So maybe when he put up the solar panels, the trees weren't yet shading them, but now they were. And the question was, did he have a legal case? So that particular case where you have somewhat complicated rights being argued over is one which could easily become more important in the future. I cannot resist the temptation to tell you one of my favorite externality stories, almost certainly bogus. This is a story which I heard long ago as being set in Japan and involving a wise judge called Judge Uke. And I think I later traced a version of it to Renaissance Italy, I think. So I don't know who first told the story. But the story goes as follows. There is a poor student. And this poor student has only enough money to eat rice. But he has noticed that there is a bakery which bakes pastries and roast meats and such. And boy, is the smell of those roast meats and bakeries, isn't that delicious? And so he has gotten into the habit of sitting just outside the bakery's property by the bakery, eating his rice, flavored with the scent of all this good food coming out of the bakery. And eventually, the owner of the bakery notices him doing this and says, you know, why is it that you always sit and eat your lunch here right next to my property? And he goes, well, I get this. All I have is rice, but there's this wonderful flavor from the scent coming out of your bakery. And he says, well, you mean to say you are stealing the flavor of my food? And so they go to court. And there is Judge Uke to settle the question. And each of them makes his case, and the owner of the bakery says, look, I spend time and money baking these things. I'm producing this delicious scent, and he's getting it for nothing. And Judge Uke says to the poor student, do you have any money? And the student says, well, I have 3 copper coins. Give them to me. The student somewhat reluctantly gives Judge Uke the coins, and Judge Uke pours the coins right into that thing. towards the back, clink, 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 and the bakery guy is looking sort of avariciously at the coins. Judge Uke hands the coins back to the student. And the bakery head, wait a minute, aren't those coins mine? The sound of the money pays for the smell of the food. A bathroom works, but it's a good story. And then an externality story, right? A story about positive externalities. And it does raise the interesting question about why we generally do not, or do, why is it that we mostly don't have tort suits for positive externalities? After all, that's what he's doing. He's saying, I'm providing a benefit which you're not paying for, and I'm going to sue you for it. Can you think of any cases in modern law where you get to sue for an unasked benefit? I only know of one, but there may be others. When can I do something good for you and charge for it? I'm not counting government, which does that all the time, although you can argue that it's good, and that's what taxes are. But if you think about ordinary private parties, when can a private party provide a valuable service unasked to another private party and then go to a court to get paid for it? Yep.
The person getting the benefit knows that the person who's receiving it has the expectation. This is sort of reasonable.
I'm thinking of a much simpler case, and that's where you're in an auto accident, you're lying there unconscious, and by good luck a doctor comes by. And my understanding of the usual legal rule is that the doctor is allowed to treat you on the grounds that it's obvious you would want to be treated, and he can't bargain with you because you're unconscious, and then send you a bill for his services, whatever the usual rates are. But that's rather unusual. It's an interesting question to think about why we don't, why we aren't more willing to do that. Let's go back to Coase and Judge Uke. And the question is Coase right in this case? How might the decision as to whether or not the baker has a property right over the smell of his food affect anybody's behavior? Yep.
Perhaps it makes some people less likely to buy because
why would they be less likely to buy?
Because they can get some of the enjoyment for free.
I see. That's interesting. It might be a substitute. You can imagine that case. You could also imagine, not very plausibly in this story, the case where the bakery is almost bankrupt, where he can't quite cover his costs selling food, but he could cover his costs selling food plus smell. But in that case, if Coase is right, what would happen if that were really the case? Let's make it not just a poor student. Everybody in the town enjoys smelling the smell of this bakery. What does Coase tell us would happen? The baker truthfully announces, I'm going to have to go out of business. I'm sorry, but I'm making 500 coins a month, and it's costing me 502 coins a month to operate the bakery, so what's going
to
happen?
His
neighbors are going to say, well, look, we're going to chip in. We're going to offer to pay if you'll agree to keep the bakery going. And you can even imagine more. You can imagine that the baker might be able to modify his operations in ways which change the amount of good smell. He could, you know, change his ventilation to make sure that the smell came out in a place that was convenient. He could put benches out there for people to sit on while enjoying the smell of eating their rice. But again, the Coase argument says, if this is something which would be worth doing, including the benefit to the people who are getting the benefit, and he wouldn't do it otherwise, then it will pay them to make a side payment to him to get him to do it. All right. So, just thinking to what extent those are real cases. Let's think about this question. Can you think about cases where people impose substantial externalities and there is not either a Coasean or a Pigouvian step taken? Where, in other words, because of course one of the solutions to externalities is to ignore them, to just say, well, sorry, we're not going to get a perfectly efficient outcome, but there's no better solution. I guess one example that occurs to me is that every time I drive through downtown Chicago, I look up at the Sears building and say, boy, isn't that a handsome building? And yet, do people know the Sears building? It's the tallest building in Chicago. Not sure if it was ever, I don't know if it was ever the tallest building in the world, maybe for a little while. But anyway, this is a nice building. It looks much less geometrical and more like a mountain than most big buildings. So I get utility, I get pleasure out of that. And yet, Sears has not tried to put a curtain around the building and say, we'll only open it if you'll pay us. There is no mechanism, as far as I know, by which I can do it. You might argue, I suppose, that governments often subsidize in various ways construction projects, and maybe those are an attempt to deal with that. Similarly, I not uncommonly see people wearing T-shirts which have neat slogans on them. Now, sometimes people may look funny if you sort of stare to try to read the slogan on the T-shirt, but sometimes it's actually a funny slogan. My son has one which shows a picture, as I remember, of somebody with a book up here who's just run into a lamppost. And the slogan is, if you've never tripped over a fire hydrant or apologized to a lamppost, you're wasting valuable reading time. It's a funny thing. That's an externality, right? I'm getting a benefit from it, yet I don't. To collect for that benefit. So let's go back to the puzzle, in a sense, that this case gives, which is the more general puzzle of what does all of this have to do with how judges actually act. And it seems to me that there are a number of possible explanations. And one possible explanation is that the judge doesn't really need the right rule, he just needs some rule, because the Coase theorem works. So if you believe that these are cases where transaction costs are low, you can say all we really need is that there be a legal system which answers these questions, which answers the question, do you or don't you have a right to build your building up? Do you or don't you have a right to block his van? And once we've got that, then people know what their rights are and they can bargain for the efficient outcome. Well, that's one possible answer. And that would then suggest that if market transactions are easy, what we want is an arbitrary property rule, and if market transactions are not so easy, maybe we want an arbitrary liability rule. But in any case, all we really need is a rule. But another possibility, and maybe a more interesting one, is that maybe the rule is a proxy for some of the real considerations. So I mentioned, I think last time, I'm pretty sure I mentioned the coming to the nuisance argument, and that's a case where although a lot of people would think of it as sort of a moral argument, whose fault it is, an economist would say, look, this is just a proxy for who is the lower cost adjuster. That we know that sunk costs aren't sunk until they've been paid, and until you've built your building, you can move it somewhere else at no cost, and therefore this looks like an arbitrary rule at first, but it is really an arbitrary rule which is sensibly designed to give you the right answer most. What would be the argument against? Why might you not want to accept the coming to the nuisance argument? Suppose you believe that the expansion of the city was predictable. Suppose you believe that when I built my pig farm, I knew or should have known that 5 years later the most valuable use of all this land around me would be for suburban housing. Why did I build the pig farm in a world with the coming to the nuisance defense?
So they pay you more to get rid of it.
I had just, in effect, gotten ownership over 20 times the land I own, namely every place my pig farm could be smelled from. So under that legal rule, I have an incentive to build a pig farm, even if it's not worth building, in order to, in effect, get an option on all the land around it, because anybody who owns that land will have to pay me off if they want to use it right now. So if you believe that the typical situation is one in which the first mover could anticipate the second mover, then you might plausibly argue that we don't want to have a first-in-time, first-in-right rule, but some more complicated rule, which I think is what, I don't know if that's the reason, but I think many courts do it that way. Going back to this case, why is it that the unconfined channel of air you don't have a right to, and the confined channel of air you do? You might plausibly argue that confined channels of air are well defined, that it's much easier to transact. There's just that one mine shaft. Whereas in this case, how do we use the rules to cover everybody else in the area whose building might, to some extent, interfere with my with the draft over my chimney? So I don't know if that's the right answer, but I'm really sort of suggesting possibilities, not things that I know. But the basic possibility is that you might either have an arbitrary rule which is just there in order to get an answer, or you might have a rule that's not so arbitrary that it's the design to give the, on average, more efficient answer. Further point that Toast makes, and which is relevant to his other famous article, which is called The Theory of the Firm, is that a different way of solving the transaction, one way of solving the transaction costs of organizing these things is a firm. So let's suppose we believe that the bargaining involved in all this can end up very costly, very difficult. What's the obvious alternative for one of the two parties? Buy the other one out. If I own both the brewery and the yard, I don't think it was a house yard, I remember it was the yard or something, maybe the yard, the inn or something, which the van is in, then all of the costs are mine, and I can now say to myself, all right, do I lose more by having these smells in my courtyard than I gain by being able to ventilate my brewery? All right. Can you think in the modern context what very large example of solving a whole bunch of problems that we usually think of as problems to be solved by government or perhaps by costly negotiations have you routinely seen in our society? Where do you have the solution of single common owner used to coordinate lots of economic actors?
Utilities.
I don't see how that's a single common...
They
have a monopoly, but I'm talking about the case where our actions are interdependent, which suggests a role for maybe tort law or maybe government regulation or maybe COSIA negotiation. And we solve the problem instead by having the same person own both enterprises in order that he will take account of both effects. And what is a large-scale, very common example of that in modern-day America? About 2 miles from here, I think. What?
McDonald's?
No, Valley Fair. Think of shopping malls. Right, a shopping mall is a private town. It's got its own security. It keeps things clean. It provides its own parking. What's it doing? Well, you can see the problem. Imagine that we have 20 different stores. Each of them has paid the cost of having a parking lot in front of it. My store isn't very popular. Yours is very popular. All your overflow people park in my lot. And I'm paying for your parking. Do it as a mall. The mall provides parking for everybody. The existence of that parking means that the shops are willing to pay more for the right to be a shop in the mall because there's parking for their customers. The mall can do all sorts of coordination if it's worth doing. All right? The mall can say, as I think they routinely do, in order to get enough customers for our smaller shops, the smaller shops are one which one customer in 50 is going to want. So it's only going to be viable for small shops if we've got a substantial flow of people coming through. Therefore, the first thing we'll do is to get an anchor store. The first thing we'll do is negotiate on very generous terms to put in a target at this end, or some high, if not targeted, Valley Fair. It's not sure what it is. But anyway, some big department store type thing. That'll get us our flow. And on the other hand, they'll say, we're not going to have any real use of all this wonderful parking after 9 o'clock, so we ought to put in a movie theater over there, and we can provide the movie theater with parking at no cost to us because it's empty parking otherwise, and we can charge the movie theater for the attraction of not having to provide its own parking lot. So if you think about it, what a shopping mall is really doing is coordinating a whole bunch of interrelated enterprises under a single owner. Single owner is contracting with other owners, of course. He doesn't typically own the individual stores, but he owns all the property and he can therefore make the rules in question. And if you think about his situation, the owner of the mall is really facing very much the same problems as the lawmaker that we've been implicitly discussing when we're considering what the efficient rules are. Because the owner of the mall, in deciding which stores go where, for example, has three alternatives. He could have a regulatory solution. He could say, all right, all restaurants go here. We're going to call this a food court. Because I believe that will best benefit our customers, and therefore will bring in more people, and therefore let me rent out the rest of the mall for a higher price. He could say, we're going to use a Pigouvian solution. What is the Pigouvian solution? We are going to measure the number of people who go into each store, and we're going to do polling to figure out what people came in order to go to that store. And we'll give rent reduction to stores that pull people into the mall, because that's going to increase the number of customers from my other stores and make them willing to pay higher rents. That would be essentially a Pigouvian solution to the problem. Or you could have the pure Kosian solution, which is says, I'm going to rent out this territory so much per square feet. You people negotiate among yourselves. If the movie theater thinks it'll do better if there's a restaurant next to it, let the movie theater and the restaurant negotiate with each other for how they arrange. So in effect, putting it under one roof, it doesn't eliminate the problems. It just means that the problems are now being dealt with by a private owner for his profit maximization rather than through a political or legal system for whatever conditions it's trying to achieve. And part of what the question which is raised, and this gets into Coase's other famous article, is where do we draw the boundaries between the firm and the market? All right? You could imagine an economy in which no firm had more than one person in it. Or you could imagine something which everything was subcontracting, and everything was in the form of, I pay you to do X, I pay him to do Y, I pay him to put X and Y together, I pay him to sell the product of X and Y, and so forth. That would be a sort of a pure market system in some sense. And one can imagine, on the other hand, a fully integrated firm, an auto firm which runs its own steel mills and its own iron ore mines and its own rubber factories and its own tire factories, its own glass works, produces everything. We don't in practice see either of those. All right, those are two extremes, one of which is doing all of its coordination through the market and one of which is doing all of its coordination through the firm. We can think of as hierarchy, roughly. Somebody gives orders to somebody else. And Coase's explanation of why firms are as they are is that there are costs to both. That there are transaction costs to market arrangements, there are transaction and related costs to hierarchical arrangements. As your organization gets bigger, it's harder for the guy at the top to know what everybody else is doing. And since in the hierarchical system, your reason for doing a good job is not to sell your product to somebody else, but just to hope that your supervisor isn't watching when you do a bad job, the costs of the levels of hierarchy and observation get higher as you get bigger firms. And therefore, depending on the industry, you get some balance between the two of those. Does that make sense? Because it's really, I mean, in a sense, all of economics is one subject. And we're thinking of it mostly from imaginary lawgivers, but we could just as well be thinking of it from an imaginary CEO who's trying to decide, should I spin off some parts of my enterprise contract out, or should I buy out another firm and join them to the ties? And it's really the same set of issues of different ways of coordinating at different costs. And as Coase says, yet another solution to the problem is government regulation. That's what we started with, really. But you can imagine coordinating people either by tort law or by Coasean contracts or by putting it all under one roof, or by having government regulation. In some circumstances, that might be the least costly, and in some other circumstances, that might not. And one of the lessons Coase is trying to teach is there isn't a perfect solution. That it's not enough to say, this has these problems. The question is, have more or fewer problems, or more or less serious problems, than one of the other solutions. going back to doing nothing, which is obviously another solution to the externality problem. And there are a lot of them. For example, I presume that most males at Santa Clara University get a benefit when women make themselves look nice, dress well, walk around maybe without too many clothes on, do various things that result in a more attractive environment for us. And I presume, never having been a woman, that there are some analogous effects in the opposite direction from their standpoint. Similarly, There are schools that have dress codes, and presumably part of the theory of a dress code is that the environment looks nicer if you have it. There are other theories as well, like avoiding gang symbols and such, depending on what kind of school it is. But you can see that there are a whole lot of areas where we may choose to just ignore the externalities because it costs more than it's worth to try to deal with. What does all of this say about the law? where transaction costs are low, the law, the legal rule doesn't matter very much as long as there is one. But where transaction costs are high, then the court decisions matter. If the transaction costs are high, then this decision either results in that being used for a brewery or it's not being used for a brewery if you can't manage transactions between the parties. And there you would like to have the courts try and figure out somehow what's the lower cost of lawyer, what's the least efficient use, and define the rules accordingly. One further point that he makes that he's really arguing with Pigou, who wasn't alive at that point to argue back, is that Pigou wants to put the situation in terms of presence or absence of state action. Do we have laissez-faire and leave things alone, or have the government intervene? Coase points out that to begin with, quite often the sort of thing that Pigou is complaining about is the result of state action. And in particular, if you went through his detailed discussion of the railroad case, which was a certain amount of tongue-in-cheek element as to, you know, which year is Pigou thinking of? Well, it was this year that the reason they weren't liable is that Parliament had authorized the building of railroads and passed a statute saying that railroads weren't liable for throwing sparks. That's not laissez-faire. On the other hand, Coase would, I think, say there is no laissez-faire. Because whatever you're doing, there are some legal rules saying who's liable for something, and what those legal rules are is going to help affect what happens. All right, I think I'm about running out of energy at this point. If you have nothing else to do, reroute and read Coase to see if you more understand the problem after the discussion. And if you have things in Coase that you'd like to talk about, we can talk about it next time, and I will try to look at that end of the chapter and see if I can figure out what I was saying there, because I've forgotten.